From the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target.
I'm Ben Ponce. Today on Target, we'll discuss a recent campus safety incident, as well as the faculty meeting's discussion of freedom of expression.
Then, we'll talk to Gettysburg Borough Mayor Ted Streeter about monuments and more. Stay with us.
Well, here we are for what I think is the sixth edition of On Target. Maybe it's the fifth, but I can't count that high anyway. I'm not a math major, so whatever edition it is October. This is our first October episode. Thanks for staying with us. You missed an episode. Well, we missed an episode last week, but we are back in action.
Back in action. Back and better than ever.
Back and better than ever, you might say. We do have a pretty quality booking. The mayor of Gettysburg, Ted Streeter, joined us. We already recorded that conversation. It is well worth the listen. Although, don't skip ahead, because then you'll miss all this excitement that we're about to discuss right now. So we're recording this on Thursday evening, October 5th. Last night, today we released our fourth print edition of the year. And so last night, Jamie and I, as we tend to do, well, actually, Jamie was trying to do two things at once. He was trying to simultaneously take a four-hour finance exam and publish the Gettysburgian all in an evening's work. And so he was dutifully working on this exam when we had just sent in the print edition. I'd done all my final proofreading. Hopefully there were no typos, because I just admitted that they're all my fault if there are. But anyway, so I had done my proofreading. We had sent it in at 11 o'clock, an hour before our midnight official deadline with the printer. We were in good shape.
Fantastic shape.
I was packing up my stuff, and an email comes in. And I don't like to read my email. Well, that's not true.
Oh, come on, Ben.
I'm actually a pretty religious reader.
You obsess over email.
Emails.
It is literally your favorite thing.
Yeah, if I had to choose between email and, I don't know, I'd choose email. So anyway, I'm reading my email, and there's an email that comes in from Ivan Taylor, who was the Department of Public Safety officer in charge last evening. And it's not a timely warning, but it is a campus security alert that said that a variety of law enforcement outlets, including the State Police, Gettysburg Police, and National Park Service Police, had established a perimeter that, based on the streets that it included, encompassed pretty much all of East Quad of campus, all around Hanson and Musselman Hall and Patrick Hall and the other hall over there that I'm forgetting. And so it was between Carlisle Street and Washington Street,
yeah.
And then up top at Water.
Yep, up at Water, all the way up to Railroad, actually. So this included Ice House Complex. It was basically everything.
Except the West Academic Quad, basically.
Basically, except for West Quad, Apple Quarry. Everything else was included.
Yeah, and so this email said that there was a police were in pursuit of a man who had fled his vehicle as part of a police chase. I actually spoke with a Gettysburg resident of the town earlier today, and he said that he saw this incident begin in front of his home with a car screeching to a halt and then someone coming out, and he'd not know what was happening, but he saw a whole bunch of police behind. I think wisely he just locked the door and proceeded with his evening.
Yeah, that's definitely the best advice in that kind of situation.
But anyway, so this happened somewhere. I'm not entirely sure where he lives, but he lives somewhere within the perimeter. And in any case, this email said that there's a suspect or two suspects possibly on the loose, one of whom may have a gun. But it did not really call for students to take any sort of precautions. It was just a notification. So I, as you normally do when you find out someone is armed and dangerous in an area, walked outside of the Plank Gym and walked towards the police perimeter to see what was going on.
Very, very advisable. That is definitely an action everyone should take.
Hopefully the college's general counsel or insurance company or both are listening to this. And anyway, so as I'm walking over there, I get to the corner of Washington and Water Street, and the Park Service police is there. So I take a photo, and we, release online. And Jamie had, I had bothered him enough that he put down his exam and called up DPS. and asked, you know, is Gettysburg College a crime scene right now? And they wouldn't comment on that. And then you asked what action students should take, and they said to shelter in place.
Which was not interesting in the email. Yeah, because they did not activate the siren that's supposed to indicate that you should be sheltering in place, that they test twice a year, actually three times a year, once in the summer, fall, and then again in the spring semester. So it was very strange. That wasn't activated. There were no text messages, no email even that indicated that we should be sheltering in place. I only found out because the DPS dispatcher told me about it. So it seems like either the DPS guy was a little bit misinformed or that there was a little bit of a breakdown in the emergency alert process.
Yeah, and we'll certainly be looking into that in the coming days.
Yeah.
What I think is... It seems to me, and this is pure speculation, but it seems to me that perhaps they were telling anyone who called to shelter in place just as sort of a precaution because they figured the people who called would be the ones who were the most bent out of shape. So I don't know. That's very odd. There were I came back to the Gettysburg office later, and there were two students who were actually recording, had just gotten done airing their show right here on WZBT, and they... were sheltering in place. They were very surprised that I had wandered outside. But, you know, all in the name of journalism.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that situation was an active situation for almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then finally we got an email around 1:15 or so. It's all online at the Gettysburgeon's website, and I'd encourage you to check out that coverage. So eventually the situation was ended and it had moved far south of campus. But I don't believe, as of Thursday evening, I don't believe a suspect has been apprehended in connection with this incident. I think it had moved south of campus, which is what you, what Jamie found out from the DPS when you called a second time. But as far as we know, no suspect has been apprehended to date, which is interesting.
Yeah, I spoke with Officer Ryan Eicher, I think that's how you pronounce it, of the Cumberland Township Police last night, and he said that they have no idea where these suspects are or, you know, so that was as of last night. I haven't spoken to him today, but I know that they did have the car in their possession and they were getting a search warrant to be able to search it because they, you know, are looking for some sort of, obviously, if they were fleeing. So he said that the initial incident was actually in Biglerville Borough. That's what he said. That it was a routine traffic stop is what he described it as for a traffic violation that was not defined by him on the phone. And they fled the scene. And then the police ultimately used the spiked stop sticks to be able to stop the vehicle. And it ended up coming to rest right at Railroad Street where they then fled. But he... did not have any indication as to the whereabouts of either of them when I spoke to him last night.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, and particularly on a campus like this where those sorts of incidents are not terribly common, I think there were some people who were a little bit on edge last night.
Absolutely.
So that's the excitement. I got a text from my mother this morning saying, looks like you had some excitement on campus last night. And yes, Mom, we did, in fact.
It was a great opportunity for some breaking news coverage, which is always great. And luckily, nobody was hurt. The police say that they don't have any confirmation that there even was ever a weapon. And Officer Eicher actually said that the campus was never in any real danger. So, you know, sort of a... You know, it could have been a lot worse. So it's good that the situation worked out the way that it did.
Yeah, I am intrigued to know what the rationale behind releasing that there was a possible weapon was if there was never any incident of that.
So, well, we got an email with more information from Ivan Taylor, who said that they were speaking to the same person, by the way. I found out later on. And he told them that they had seen a shiny object thrown from the car that they initially thought could have been a gun. But it turned out when they located said object that it was not a gun.
It's so interesting to me that they would A, release that there might have been a gun, but B, not activate, you know, campus, say, you know, the alert system or the text message system. That seems to be a bit of an interesting dichotomy.
Well, you know, it was all very strange because there was never any indication they'd actually committed a crime at that point, just that they had fled the police, which, of course, is a crime, but any kind of serious crime. Like, they hadn't actually fired a weapon. There was no confirmation of that. So it wasn't an active shooter incident. So maybe that's why the siren wasn't activated. I'm not sure.
We will, like I said, look into that. The other news of the week, Jamie, you just came from the Gettysburg College biweekly faculty meeting.
I did indeed.
At which there was a roundtable discussion of the freedom of expression policy. Let me just set the scene here, and then Jamie will go to you and you can share what happened. Last spring, President Riggs, on the heels of the Robert Spencer incident, in which the Young Americans for Freedom invited controversial speaker Robert Spencer to discuss the political ramifications of Islamic fundamentalism, was the title of his speech. And Riggs, on the heels of that incident, said to the campus community that she was hoping for a process that would help the campus work towards an affirmative statement on what types of freedom of expression we are or are not okay, what types of expression we are or are not okay with. Historically, she has said to us several times that she errs on the side of freedom of expression. We spoke with her actually in the very first edition of this podcast, and here's what she had to say about that.
I do continue to think about this issue, and I'm sure many people on campus have been thinking about it a lot. And yes, I do value freedom of expression. And I think we have to value that on a college campus. My goal would be for us to be able to adopt a statement as an institution, and we haven't really laid out that process yet. We'll be doing that soon.
And so on the heels of that process that she referred to is now underway. There's a committee of seven that has begun the process of evaluating statements at other colleges and is soliciting input today. They solicited input from the faculty at the faculty meeting. Later this weekend, they'll be talking to the Board of Trustees, who are having one of their meetings on campus this weekend. And then Student Senate will later be involved in the process. So the timeline, as I understand it, Jamie, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that they're in the information and input gathering phase now. Yep. By November, they're going to try and have something released. And then where's the process go from there?
So when the statement is released in November to the general campus community, President Riggs said today that she wants to have a broad discussion about what this statement is. And Professor Bloomquist actually spoke today also and said that what we're creating right now is not a policy. We're not creating a policy. We're creating a philosophy that will inform later policies. So I thought that was really interesting, and that's something that I hadn't really heard yet from the discussion. We're really looking to define a philosophy of what we define freedom of expression to be, rather than a concrete policy about what's allowed, what's not allowed, and sanctions. And
is such a policy in the cards down the line? So the institutional. So what I'm hearing from you, so the institutional philosophy is what this process is about, and that comes first, and then subsequently, would it fall on the student life committee?
So basically, what's going to happen is come November, the statement's going to be released. There's going to be input from the campus community, and then President Riggs hopes to take it to a vote. She didn't define who's going to get to vote, but that there would be a vote on it of some variety early in the spring semester. That is her pie-in-the-sky timeline, and she pretty much described it as that. She's hoping that we can get there, but she recognizes there can be challenges with that. So then after we get this, affirmative statement on freedom of expression and the philosophy that we have around that, then I can only assume that the process from there would go to the Student Life Committee to inform student policy, and then to Faculty Council, I would assume, that handles governance of faculty. And I'm not really sure what body. There is a Support Staff Council, but I'm not sure if they define rules and regulations for the support staff. But this would be a sort of a campus policy that would then So a campus philosophy that would then inform policies for the various constituencies.
So would the student life committee be responsible for defining a policy on future campus speakers?
I don't know for sure. I would assume that it's possible that that could be part of it. I think that's something that student life committee is probably going to figure out. But student life committee is the one that are the ones that create policies. If you remember, they created the unauthorized recording policy that we've picked apart on the show several times. They created the current posting policy that we have. They actually instituted the current philosophical statement that is in the handbook around freedom of expression. So they are really the ones that define student governance and what policies and things are going to apply to students.
And do you have any sense of who is on this committee of seven and how those members were selected?
So President Riggs did offer some insight to this today. She said that really Professor Bloomquist was sort of her first pick because she wanted somebody from the academic realm. And as associate provost, she was recommended. She didn't say by who, but she was recommended to serve on the committee. So Professor Bloomquist was selected first is how it sounded to me. And then from there, she recruited two other faculty members, Hakeem Williams, Professor Hakeem Williams, and Professor Reyes. I'm not sure of Professor Reyes' first name.
Hakeem Williams from Africana Studies, yes. And Ivanova Reyes from Economics.
Yeah. Yes. So those are the faculty members of the committee. There is also on the committee Jeff Foster from College Life. He's the administrative person from College Life who was selected to serve on the committee. There was a student, Patrick McKenna, who she said was selected because he has an interest in policy, and he was recommended by someone who, again, remained nameless.
Yeah, Pat McKenna is the chair of the Senate Policy Committee, and he is the Senate parliamentarian. And so, yes, I've spoken with him, and we're actually going to be working on setting up an interview with him in the coming days and weeks to talk a little bit more about this process.
Yeah. And then also on the committee is obviously President Riggs and apparently two board members. Their names are escaping me, but there are two board members who are sort of involved in this process. They have not actually been here, but they have called into a couple meetings. They've met three times so far. And sort of that's this meeting today. The discussion of the faculty meeting today came out of that. Those three meetings and the content that was discussed when the Freedom of Expression Committee met those three times.
So there are three faculty members, including Jennifer Bloomquist, who's the associate provost, I believe, for faculty development.
Yes.
One student, President Riggs, Jeff Foster, and two members of the Board of Trustees.
That's my understanding.
So it's eight.
Yes.
Okay. And so that timeline is that they will be working towards developing a statement that will be released in November. We also have a handout from that meeting at which they kind of picked apart some statements from other institutions, including Franklin and Marshall, Georgetown, Augustana College, Hamilton College, Denison University, the University of Chicago, as well as looking at institutional statements that we have to date. And they look at some pros and cons. Is there anything that stood out to you about this document or about the discussion that you heard today, Jamie?
I think, you know, our discussion, so it was small group discussion. We didn't actually have any sort of open mic. So I can't speak to what the other groups were speaking about, but we were talking a lot about the problems with trying to define what is hate speech, because we all at the table sort of came to an agreement that whatever hate speech is, it's something that probably is not something that we want to have on our campus. But where we disagreed is where the line for hate speech is and where that should be drawn and how it should be defined. Mm-hmm. It's just so tough to draw that line of, you know, because we are a private institution, we don't have the same standards, but still supporting that freedom of inquiry.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and this may give you a sense of where this committee might be heading. I'm looking at this document with pros and cons, and under Franklin and Marshall's statement, a con is listed in particular, their last point, which reads, quote, challenging behavior and speech whose demonstrable intent is to demean, harass, or limit the sense of security and belonging of any member of the college community as they participate in the pursuit of knowledge, end quote, is listed under the con section. While on the pro section of the Georgetown University speech, it says it's a very strong statement about respecting freedom of speech, and it mandates the university to protect freedom of speech when it is being coerced by members of the community. I think they mean criticized. I'm not sure coerced is the right word. But anyway, the quote there is, quote, deliberation or debate may not be suppressed because the ideas put forth are thought by some or even by most members of the university community to be offensive, unwise, immoral, or ill-conceived. To this end, the university has a solemn responsibility not only to promote a lively and fearless freedom of deliberation and debate, but also to protect that freedom when others attempt to restrict it, unquote. So it seems like this committee is going to be certainly take some strong positions and precautions towards protecting limitations on freedom of speech. Was that the sense that you got today, Jamie?
That is a lot of what we talked about also. So we were talking about, like, what is the line of when it becomes harassment? You know, what is that line? But we also talked about the importance of protecting diverse opinions and allowing everyone to have a voice. And I think that's a lot of what that language is about, making sure that certain that there's not censorship going on, because, you know, it can be very easy to sort of try to create this vacuum where you are only talking to people that are that think like you. And I think, you know, one of the things that at least my group was trying to discern is the difference between, you know, somebody having a different opinion and somebody just hating somebody because of some characteristic or because of who they are. So that's sort of, you know, you can have a difference of opinion on issues, but we were focusing more along the lines of when you start attacking people personally.
Certainly. And I'm just going to read one more quote here. This is under the University of Chicago's statement. And this is a somewhat lengthy quote, but I think it's worth reading, particularly because there is significant discussion within this document of the University of Chicago statement, which may portend its use as a model for our college. That's speculation. But here's what their statement, a selection from their statement, quote, more recently, president of University of Chicago, Hannah Holborn Gray, observed that education should not be intended to make people comfortable. It is meant to make them think. Universities should be expected to provide the conditions within which hard thought and therefore strong disagreement, independent judgment, and the questioning of stubborn assumptions can flourish in an environment of the greatest freedom. As a corollary to the university's commitment to protect and promote free expression, members of the university community must also act in conformity with the principle of free expression. Although members of the university community are free to criticize and contest the views expressed on campus and to criticize and contest speakers who are invited to express their views on campus, they may not obstruct or otherwise interfere with the freedom of others to express views they reject or even loathe. To this end, the university has a solemn responsibility not only to promote a lively and fearless freedom of debate and deliberation, but also to protect that freedom when others attempt to restrict it, which you'll note is the same selection that was in the Georgetown University statement.
Interesting. So apparently the Chicago statement came first. There was some discussion around this today. Apparently some colleges stole wholesale from the Chicago statement without attribution. So that's interesting. There was some discussion that there's a lot of overlap and people really like this Chicago statement and have been borrowing, and some have not been following the academic integrity principles.
Well, that certainly is a different issue. Although I think that that excerpt, to that end, the university has a solemn responsibility not only to promote a lively and fearless freedom of debate and deliberation, but also protect that freedom when others attempt to restrict it. I think that really encapsulates the heart of where I think a lot of people fall on this issue, which is that, you know, there is offensive speech that must be protected.
Absolutely. You know, just because you're uncomfortable doesn't mean that your environment is now unsafe. So when it falls into the actual, like, you know, category of harassment is when somebody is actually unsafe. If you just feel uncomfortable because you're confronted with viewpoints that are different than your own, that is not something that the college wants to be restricting. You know, I know that at least the people at my table said that, you know, college is all about being uncomfortable. That's the whole way that you learn, is, you know, through this transformative experience and being uncomfortable and going outside of your comfort zone.
Although, as I think back to last spring when Todd Green was brought to campus as a counter speaker towards to promote a different view of than Robert Spencer, during the question and answer session, one student stood up and, instead of asking Todd Green a question, asked JMR, President Riggs, a question that was essentially quoting an email she had said that she hopes our community flourishes. And this student asked, "How do you expect us to flourish in fear?" And it seemed like there was a lot of general agreement in the room that flourishing in fear is something that is challenging and may be something the college should address. So it'll be very interesting to see where this goes in the coming days and weeks and months. And you can bet that we will be following it, as well as many students on this campus will.
Yeah. When we learn more about the Student Senate piece of this and when students are going to be able to get involved, we'll let you know. And when I get my hands or even get a whiff of a prepared statement, we will be sure to bring it to you first here on Target. I guess now we have wrapped up our news segment, and it's time for Ben Ponce to offer up our bullet report.
I really love the cadence within which you do that, Jamie. All right. Well, it's been 2 weeks since we've recorded, so that's 2 weeks of exciting bullet sports action to cover. Starting on September the 25th, the men's golf team finished third out of 17 in the Lebanon Valley Dutchman Invitational. Later the next day, on September the 26th, the field hockey team beat Stevenson 4-1. Then, on September the 27th, the men's soccer team defeated McDaniel 1-0. The volleyball team defeated Shenandoah 3-0. The women's soccer team tied Frostburg State 1-1. The men's golf team did something. They finished 3rd of 12 at the Moravian Fall Invitational. The men's cross-country team finished 12th out of 36 at the Paul Short Run on the 29th. The women's cross-country team finished 2nd out of 32, and I do believe our very own sports editor, Elizabeth Hillfrank, finished 1st in that race. Congratulations, Elizabeth Hillfrank. Then, later that day, the field hockey team defeated Bryn Mawr 3-0. The volleyball team defeated Hood 3-1. The women's soccer team demoralized Bryn Mawr 8-0. The football team picked up its first and to date only win of the season. They won 28-14 over Moravian in a battle of teams that had not yet won. So someone had to come out with a win, and yay, it was us. Then later that day, the men's golf team in the Mason-Dixon Collegiate Classic at McDaniel College tied for 8th out of 16 right there in the middle of the pack. The women's golf team at the Gettysburg Invitational finished 3rd of 7. The men's soccer team 4-1 beat Haverford. The volleyball team beat Bryn Mawr 3-0. Then on October the 2nd, the women's tennis team lost 7-2 to Shepherd. The men's tennis team, however, defeated Shepherd 6-3. The men's golf team at the Gettysburg Invitational on October the 4th finished 4th out of 12. The women's soccer team lost 1-0 to the College of New Jersey on the 4th. The men's soccer team defeated Eastern 2-1 in overtime last night on a stellar goal by Patrick Santini, who has now scored the last 10 consecutive goals for the Bullets soccer team. The field hockey team lost 6-1 to number one nationwide ranked Messiah, and the volleyball team lost just its second match of the season to Susquehanna 3-1. Thus endeth the Bullet Report.
I get tired just looking at you do that, Ben. I got to tell you, that must have been a new world record for you as far as speed of speech. Well, I have to tell you, you flew through that like it was nothing.
Well, you know, excellence is what we strive for here at the Gettysburg. And 120 years of journalistic excellence right here. All right, that's enough patting ourselves on the back. We'll be right back with Gettysburg Mayor Ted Streeter. And today we are thrilled to be joined by the mayor of Gettysburg, Ted Streeter. Mayor Streeter, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for asking me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have been the mayor of Gettysburg since June of 2016.
That's correct.
Is that correct? And you were appointed.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. My predecessor, Bill Troxell, had been mayor for something like 20 years or so, but He had health problems and had to resign, and he asked me if I would take over. I had been on the council for 14 years, was president of that for 8 years, and so I agreed to do it and have enjoyed every minute of it.
And so you're on the ballot this fall.
I am.
For your first full term.
I am, and my only full term.
And your only full term. Yeah. Well, breaking news right here.
Yeah, I announce here and now I will not run again.
Well, so you said you'd served on borough council for a number of years. We also were reading you were the president of the Gettysburg Municipal Authority.
I was the chair of the municipal authority. I've held a number of positions around town, you know, to occupy my time. Chair of the municipal authority, chair of the Adams County Transportation Organization. I was on the Central Pennsylvania Transportation Board for a while, and I'm now on the PICPI board as vice chair of that as well.
So how did you become interested in local government, and have you lived in Gettysburg for?
No. We're retired military. We came back from Germany in 1982 and stationed at Fort Ritchie, which now closed. I retired out of there, and we've lived in Gettysburg ever since. And after I got out of the Army, I went to work for the federal government for 10 or 15 years, somewhere in there. And then as a post-retirement job, went to work as a store clerk at Lord Nelson's on Chambersburg Street. Mm-hmm. And George, the owner, and I used to sit in the back room now and then and drink a little scotch and solve the world's problems. And so when the mayor previous to Bill Troxell passed away, Bill assumed that position, and I applied for his seat. We were in the same ward and was appointed, and that was in 1997 and have been involved ever since.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you consider what you've done over the past 20 or so years now working in local government, are there any particular accomplishments that stand out or things you've enjoyed? Or
I can't pick up anyone in particular. My main enjoyment is working with people and working with groups. And I'm a Leo, you know, and we're just natural leaders. And so I like to be in the forefront of things and be active in local government and help make decisions.
Mm-hmm. So among the duties of the mayor of Gettysburg, you oversee the police department.
Right, right, mm-hmm. right. That's my primary substantial duty of substance, yeah.
So mm-hmm. how do you approach that?
Well, when I inherited the mayor's job, the police were in pretty bad shape. We had three federal lawsuits against us for sexual discrimination and employment, this, that, and the other thing. And you may recall the taser incident if you were in town then, and that was pending against us. And it's taken well over a year to weed all of that out. But Joe Dougherty, who's the chief of police, and I, we're not only neighbors, we've been neighbors for 16 years or so. But we work very, very well together. Joe's a very competent guy, and we've worked over the year to solve the problems. We've revised some policies and procedures, got some new leadership in there, and I think we're well on the way. We've got a couple more steps to go, but I think we're well on the way to having a very good, it's always been good, but it's going to be a very good police department. Yeah.
Yeah, so you mentioned that the borough recently settled, or you alluded that the borough recently settled a lawsuit involving a man who was tasered several times.
Right, right.
And so that was captured on body camera
footage. It was.
Do the police still wear body cameras?
No.
That was part of a trial program.
Yeah, it was part of a trial program, and I, unfortunately, however you want to put it, the sole officer who volunteered for the trial happened to be the officer involved in the taser incident. Since then, they were immediately withdrawn, and they have not been reissued and will not be until the district attorney, who's a senior law enforcement person in the county, writes a policy regarding them. And so that's where we are right now. They haven't been used since.
Yeah, so I know that the Pennsylvania General Assembly recently passed some legislation that seemed to pave the way for that regarding the wiretapping laws. Do you think that the body cameras are something that, you know, the borough should look into? Do you think that provides accountability, or do you have other concerns?
No, I really favor the body cameras. I think it for one thing, it holds the police accountable, but it also provides them with a, I hate to use the word alibi, but a story, you know, a reason for what happened. Because, you know, they're generally always two sides to every story. And this sort of provides both sides of it. So it adds more facts to any case brought against us and ensures proper behavior on everyone's behalf.
Mm-hmm. So I know that on this campus particularly, there's some scholarly and political and I guess personal interest in the whole criminal justice system and reforms. How do you see Gettysburg fitting into that? You mentioned that the department had faced some federal lawsuits involving the civil rights case and the gender discrimination case. I guess, you know, as you work to lead the department into the future, what are your goals still remaining, and how do you see Gettysburg fitting into a broader narrative that we see nationwide?
I like to see the citizenry involved. And, you know, the police have a very good ride-along program. Any college student or faculty member, anyone in town, may go up to the department and schedule a ride-along with any officer at any time. And I think that's good. It promotes community relations, promotes an understanding of the stress involved in a police officer's job and what they go through. I mean, these guys go through. You never know when you walk up into a car what's going to happen. When you go to an incident, what's going to happen? And I think it's very educational for anybody to walk along or to ride along with them. In addition, we have coffee with a cop, which I think tomorrow is going to be tomorrow afternoon at McDonald's. At McDonald's up on Steinway Avenue there, in which any citizen is welcome to stop by and ask questions of the chief or whatever officer is on duty up there. So I think community relations is the primary direction that the police should go. The society is changing, you know. Joe tells me it used to be that the role of the cop was to catch crooks. Now they're counselors, they're drug enforcement people, and they get involved in all sorts of social situations, which they have not before. And it calls for a new kind of police officer. The old Clancy the cop, you know, is gone. And we need people who are trained in the social aspects of society and are able to deal with those types of things. And that's the way I'd like to see it go.
So shifting gears a little bit.
Sure.
We mentioned previously that you served on borough council for 14 years before you were appointed mayor.
Right.
So I'm sure you've seen a lot of evolution in the relationship between the college and the borough.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, how do you think that relationship has evolved during your time on the borough council and now as mayor?
Well, we've always had a good relationship with the college. I go back as far as Gordon Holland. I don't know if you remember him or not, but he was president when I joined. Actually, the college is a lot more involved with the borough than many people realize. It is, in fact, the largest taxpayer in the borough, and by virtue, you know, as you know, being an educational institute, it is not required to keep its properties on a tax roll, but it does voluntarily, a number of them. And the money we get from that tax is the largest amount we get from any single entity in the borough. And, we've had our differences here and there, you know. Once in a while I get a bunch of rowdy college kids, but that's, you know.
College kids, never.
No. Of course, I never did that either when I was in college, but I was a good guy. I claim close to not graduating, but other than that. We've always had good relations with the college, and now Janet is especially, I'm especially fond of Janet. President Rigg, she's a very fine person and a good and a very common person you can deal with, a person who's seen life and a person who understands the problems that we face.
So are there any major disputes between the college and borough in recent years that sort of stick out in your mind?
Not that I can recall. There may have been, but they certainly weren't major, or I would probably recall them, but I can't.
And my last question about sort of the borough and college relations is, what would you like to see change about the relationship between the college and the borough throughout your tenure as mayor?
Oh, that's hard to say. Obviously, I'd like to see the college keep more properties on the tax roll because the borough is circling the drain financially. We have for a number of years. But I think things are in a pretty good state now. The number of students living off campus, I believe, is around 200. I believe is what the college allows, and that's good. That's not too many off campus. I think we're in pretty good state, but I can't point to any one thing in particular that I'd like to see improvement on.
So one thing that kind of occurred to me the other day while I was thinking about, you know, your role as mayor is that between the college and the tourists that come in, you have a variety of constituencies that don't necessarily vote in local elections.
Yes.
How do you sort of balance all of that?
Well, you have to. One thing I try to do is keep the office of the mayor apolitical. I don't take any political stance whatsoever because you get all sorts of, as you mentioned, all sorts of visitors of varying throughout the political spectrum in town. And I hate to come down with a position and have people disagree with it. But we have 3 or 4 million visitors through Gettysburg every year, and most of them enjoy. I hear from a lot of them. So you always hear from the ones that don't have a good time. mostly parking, which is a perennial problem. You know, the town wasn't built for cars. And but it's I forget where the question was, but what was the question?
Sort of balance the various constituencies as far as tourists, college people, and course, people who live and work in the borough.
More or less, try to be all things to all people. You know, it's a big part of it is just listening and being on the receptive end and trying to adjust and identify with the person that you're talking to and speak in his or her language and listen to the subjects that they're discussing and listening is a lot better than talking. It works out fairly well.
So I know that you said that you aren't taking any political stances, but I have a couple questions that are going to get...
No comment.
Well, my first question is about DACA. You know that President Trump recently announced the end of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The Migration Policy Institute estimates that 21,000 DACA-eligible persons reside in PA, with a significant number living in Adams County. And what, if any, support do you plan to offer to DACA recipients as the program is being phased
out? As I mentioned, I keep the office apolitical. I plan to be neutral on it. I have an opinion on it. I have an opinion on everything. And I have the freedom to express those opinions, but I also have the responsibility to represent the borough. And so I don't like to come out pro or anti for fear, as I mentioned earlier, of offending any group in town. I just like to, I prefer just to cut ribbons, kiss babies, and give speeches, and more or less leave it at that without any solid political points of view.
So, I mean, but what does the borough plan to do? I mean, is there any support planned, anything that the borough plans to do to help these constituents as this program is phased out?
To my knowledge, no. But you have to understand that the mayor in this particular operates under what's called the weak mayor system. The previous mayor didn't like that term, but it is in fact true. All the power resides in the council, and my position is for the most part ceremonial, aside from the police and a few other things. So I am really not in a position to do any legislation or enact any sort of thing like that.
Do you know if borough council plans to take any action? Do you know of any plans that they may have on this front? Or
I have not heard it discussed. I don't know.
So the next question I have is about the monument controversy. That is, I mean, obviously we have a lot of them here in Gettysburg.
Well, we don't.
Not
in the borough.
That's true.
That's the point that came out. They're all in the National Park Service.
Yeah. But the Unity Park is an example of one that is in the borough. And it is supposed to mourn the many young people from both the North and the South who sacrificed and endured so much for our country. But Gettysburg College professor Scott Hancock wrote an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer in August in which he said that, quote, "Those who sacrificed and endured for the Confederacy did not do it for our country, but for their country," unquote. So I know you said you don't take stances, but would you entertain the possibility, if it was brought up, of moving that monument somewhere else? Or, you know, because there are some people who or taking off the Confederate portion, because there are people who don't agree that the Confederates should be. So do you have any kind of stance on that?
Not really. I mean, it's a valid point, but, you know, I understand those who oppose Confederate statues and that type of thing. I understand that argument. But on the end, if there's any place for the Confederate flag in the North, it's Gettysburg. I mean, you can't deny that Robert E. Lee was here, and you can't deny that a three-day battle in which 51,000 casualties occurred here. It is a fact of history, and to suppress that fact, I think, really probably harms the national psyche more than it helps it. People have to understand, you can't suppress history. You can't airbrush it away and pretend it never happened. It did happen, and it happened here. And the fact that the statues are here commemorate that, whether people agree with them or not, is another subject. But they are in fact here, and I think they probably should remain. That's my personal opinion.
Okay, so as you can look out on, it's you're running unopposed in the general election coming up. So
unless
it seems
Mickey Mouse does well, I'm pretty well in.
It sounds like you might win, as you consider it's a 4-year term.
Yes.
Do you have any goals or priorities or things that you're looking to do over the next 4 years as mayor?
No, I still have some work to do with the police department. But other than that, it's sort of you meet the crises as they come. And I can't foresee any coming down the... down the pike. So we'll try to keep the lid on. I always talk to the college students every year. I did up at the cemetery this year and have certain duties in town, riding the parades and this type of thing. But as I say, the duties are largely ceremonial, so I don't have any great goals that I can foresee right now at this time.
One ceremonial duty that I think recently occurred was a couple... How long ago was the Salsa in the Square event where we celebrated our...
September 8th, I think it was.
The sister city relationship with León, Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
What does that sort of mean to Gettysburg?
It's a great thing. You know, we have, as I think you alluded to earlier, have a very substantial Latin American Hispanic community. And they provide a lot to the economy. They're good people. They stay below the radar because I'm sure they're afraid. But they're church-going, they're family-oriented, they're a very solid bunch of people, and it's deserving that they should be recognized on a yearly and even more so basis because they do contribute to the community, they contribute to the economy, and I look forward to it every year. I'm a big fan of that. I can't do the salsa, but I love the food trucks.
I was going to say, I think food tends to be a uniting force among people of all walks of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there are several other sister city relationships. I know with Gettysburg, South Dakota also, which is kind of interesting. There's a sign as you go down, I guess it's Chambersburg Street,
right,
with the number of miles to get to Gettysburg, South Dakota. So do you have any plans to sort of strengthen that relationship or any kind of cool events that you have planned with that
actually,
relationship?
No, actually, I've never been to Gettysburg, South Dakota. I've never received an invitation to go. So I'm not sure where it is, but if they contact me, I'll be happy to talk to them. I'd be happy to go, but first I've got to find out where it is. We do have another sister city relationship with Shigahara, Japan.
Okay.
Which developed last summer. You may have recall if you were here at the train station. It was a big ceremony in which we declared our fidelity and all that sort of thing. With they had a major battle at that location and 1500 somewhere in there, which in a way was comparable to the Battle of Gettysburg because it dealt with the unity, preserving the unity of the country, the shogun, that type of thing. I haven't been invited there either. I'd like to go, though. I've been to the Far East. I'd like to go back. But those are the only two. Some Iroglaise, I would definitely like to go there with the French. I've been to Europe, having been in the military. I've been in Europe, you know, a number of years, twice at least. And to have traveled with the government there, so I like the sister city relationship. I hope to get to León one of these years, get invited to León. I think it'd be I've been to Costa Rica, I've never been to Nicaragua, but I'd like to go, and I think it's a very healthy thing, and I'm in favor of it very much.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the last question we'd have is just kind of bring this full circle. You talked a little bit about your experience in local government.
Uh-huh.
What would you say to, you know, a college student about the importance of being involved in local government?
Oh, there's no question about it. I'm sad to say if I read correctly, that they're sort of developed a them and us situation between the citizenry and government. You know, we used to have difficulty finding people to run for council in Gettysburg. Now it's competitive. There are actually people, but you don't understand democracy. Democracy depends upon everyone being involved. You can't sit aside and say let them do it. And whether you're on a library committee or the city council or the mayor or governor or something like that, involvement is necessary because our form of democracy depends upon citizen involvement. And many of the problems we face now, I think, in a national and state level, come from lack of citizen involvement, lack of keeping track and holding our representatives accountable for what they do. And I hope, not to get political, like I said, I hope the present administration will cause people to realize the necessity of being involved in government. And it starts at the low level and at the junior level, and I'm all for it.
Absolutely. Well, Mayor Streeter, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great to have you.
Thank you.
Hope to maybe have you back again in the future.
Oh, I'm always, I could talk about anything anytime. It's one of the advantages of being mayor, the bully pulpit.
Well, we're glad to have you.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
That's On Target for this week.
We'd like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian, as well as the executive board of WCBT, for their ongoing support of this project. You can subscribe to On Target on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts, as long as it's somewhere that we publish.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha of the class of 2019, who is a music major with a composition concentration from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.